AudioGo presents In the Library.
I'm Paul Blessard, and you're listening to In the Library. Linda LaPlante trained as an actress at RADA and performed with the National Theatre and the Royal Shakespeare Company before reaching wider audiences with television shows such as Minder and The Sweeney. It was while filming The Gentle Touch that she wrote four plot lines and showed them to the show's producers. They were sadly returned to her as unsuitable for production, but on one of the episodes, someone had written, "This is wonderful." That idea later became the BAFTA-nominated series Widows, and Linda went on to write such award-winning series as Prime Suspect, Trial and Retribution, and Above Suspicion. As an author, she's written such bestsellers as Bella Mafia and The Governor, and when I spoke to her in 2002 about her novel Royal Flush, I asked her about her enviable CV and if she had really done it all.
Yes. In fact, somebody asked one of my editors the other day, and they said, "Come clean, does she really write it all?" And I really do. But I do have a very good backup team around me of editors and people that correct my spellings and stuff. And, you know, I have a permanent researcher now, in residence, so to speak.
Luxury.
So, yes, I do. I love writing, though.
And you have done since you were a wee small child, apparently.
Yes, but without much luck. And I think the most difficult thing for a writer is not to have an end product to his work or her work. And I'm very fortunate. I mean, to see your stuff go on the screen, in print, gives you a great boost.
Absolutely. Before we come to television and your history, let's talk about Royal Flush. Subtitle, with this wonderful strapline, "Only one diamond is worth dying for, one race worth killing for." Where did the idea for this come from?
Sometimes when you're under the hammer, so to speak, and they say, "Well, what is your next book?" We really are looking for a big heist. I say, "Well, I've got one of those." So the heist part of the book was kind of hinted at as would be very good for me to do.
By and whom?
By my publishers.
Right.
I've always loved heists, and so I decided I'd go really for the biggest of all and try and steal the crown jewels.
Indeed. Good start. And then where did you go with it?
Having set it up, I wanted a realistic group of people that could do it and would do it. And I was told, actually, by Ronnie Cray, that all the rumours about a so-called colonel were a load of old tosh, darling.
But would you explain what the rumours are? That behind all these thing-goings, behind all the big heists, there was a shadowy figure who was pulling the strings.
That in some circles, they still believe existed, that behind the bullion raid, behind the great train robbery, behind most of the biggest raids, bank raids, security wagons, etc., has always been a fictional character, a shadowy creature, nicknamed the Colonel. Because in many of the instances, all the robberies were so very carefully worked out with military precision. Whether he existed or not, I don't know, but I took that as the start of my book.
Point.
Yeah.
And in this book, he's turns out to be Mr. De Jersey.
Edward De Jersey. Previously, Eddie Jersey of the East End.
Exactly.
Whose dad used to run a betting shop. But I love the fact that people can very quickly now hide their identity. And Edward De Jersey hid who he was, first off by going to Sandhurst as a young man, and he picked up the plummy aristocratic tones. But he's always been quite an operator until he actually reached, after the bullion raid, enough money to have his dream, which was a stud farm. And he is phenomenally successful.
He is, of course, a fictional character. Is there a pro forma for him? Have you met Edward De Jersey in your travels?
Number of them, actually. They're a sort of amalgamation of people that I've met. Because, of course, in racing, nobody's a crook. And because I've got so many racehorses myself, it was very good and easy to get the research on him. And so I tried where possible in the book to introduce elements of the racing world that are not obvious, that one doesn't really know, you know, what it's like to have a runner that goes like the wind. It fills your heart, it really does. Because horses have great, great personalities. If you have a horse that has a racing heart, he'll break it for you. I have a horse that costs a lot of money. He's good, he's athletic, he's calm, likeable, but he doesn't have the heart, doesn't particularly want to win. You feel a bit of a fool when he comes out. He's still going round the track when the others, you know, the jockeys are off them in the weighing room and, you know, getting their planes home.
So you obviously you know about the racing world.
Yeah.
So that's not too difficult to research. How up are you on the internet, which plays a seminal role in this book?
Well, that was actually quite a difficult part because, I mean, I am pretty computer friendly and I write on one. But to actually understand about thwacking, hacking, thacking, I had to pay for it and bring in slightly dodgy young people.
So you effectively, when you're researching as an author, going through the same steps that you put your character through when he's researching how to hack. And
totally.
Then you just...
Yeah. I said to this boy, one of them, tell me how I can lose my identity. And so he explained that. One of the first things, and one of the things that all the computer experts said to me, is that everything that you have on your computer, no matter if you delete it, is still there and it can be taken off. I said, well, how can that not happen? And he said, there is only one way, and that is the satellite dish.
Yes.
And they taught me how to create a fictional person, because on the net you can get a bank account.
Absolutely.
You can rent an apartment, a car. You can get a driving license.
You can exist as a whole.
You can exist, yes, as a whole entity. Banking facilities. And so when you disappear, you just bleep it out and you are gone. And that is the only way. So that was one part. Then I had to learn how you hack into phone lines and things that were very illegal. It was a fascinating process for me, but still very, very complicated.
How structured are you about doing your research before you write? How does it work? Do you know what the end of the book is before you write the beginning? Do you map it all out, or do you plunge yourself in and see where the story takes you?
I do plunge in and see which direction it will go, but I also do have a pretty good shape. But things, whilst writing, alter, because I was going to hit the Tower of London, and so I lurked around there viewing the crown jewels for a suspiciously long time. And I thought, I'm never going to get in here. And I always go with logic. If something is illogical, I won't touch it. If something somebody says that is totally illogical and could never happen, then I won't do it. So I thought, I'm never, ever going to get in. I can't do it. Meanwhile, my hacker's getting stuff off the internet with regard to the Queen when they're wearing a crown. And I noticed on one occasion going through, it said, not in use. So I asked what they were doing. They said, oh, repairing. And they very freely said, he said, there are many of the repairs to the crown jewels are done actually in the premises of the tower. But with the Jubilee coming up and so many crowns required, they will be working off the premises. And I thought, here we go.
Where's the weakness?
Got it.
Linda, time for the first extract, please. Perhaps you'd like to introduce and read it for us.
The little bit I'm going to read is, I think, quite interesting. It's because the men begin to gather for the robbery, but they are going to require Her Majesty the Queen, a lookalike. But Her Majesty the Queen also will have a lady-in-waiting. And it's, how do you secure, when you're going to do a very risky armed robbery, a lady that you will be able to trust and not lose her nerve? He decides to trace Pamela Kenworthy Wright. The Jersey thought his own rented flat in Kilburn was run down, but compared to Pamela's place, it was a palace. She had a bedsit in an old converted fort in Plymouth. To gain access to the apartments, you had to cross a drawbridge before entering the main courtyard, which was filled with boarded-up huts, stray dogs, cats scuttled around, stinking rubbish bags outside the building, broken sinks, lavatories, fridges littered the corridors, which were cold and damp. The stench of urine pervaded the stairs and the second-floor corridor leading to bedsit number 20. There was a sign on the door that read, "Do not disturb before 11 a.m, thank you." The Jersey smiled and rapped on the door. "Who is it?" demanded an authoritative, aristocratic voice. "Philip Simmons," the Jersey heard the lock slide back and the door was edged open. Are you from social services? No. So what do you want? To talk to you. I met you a long time ago. He smiled pleasantly. Well, I don't recognise you, and I'm very busy right now. Please, Miss Kenworthy Wright, I really do need to speak to you about something that may prove very lucrative. Do you have identification? He produced his driving licence in his fictional name. Oh, come in, I need my reading glasses. She disappeared into the flat and he followed. It was better furnished than he'd expected, and with good quality rug on the floor and comfortable leather armchairs. She also had a computer, a large TV set, and the gas fire made it very warm. A few large oil paintings of gentlemen in wigs and dour-faced women dominated the walls. A sofa bed with an orange duvet took up the rest of the room, dangerously close to the fire. Pamela was wearing a velvet dressing gown over her skinny frame with rabbit fur slippers. She delved into a cloth bag and brought out her glasses, held them to her nose, glanced at his driving license, and passed it back to him. "What do you want? May I sit down?" She shrugged. Her face was heavily wrinkled, and lipstick rivulets ran from her thin lips in rows of tiny red lines. Only her eyes retained a spark of brightness. They were a wonderful china blue, enhanced by the dark shadows of old mascara. Her hair was dyed, probably by herself, in various shades of dark auburn tinged with grey. "Do you want some coffee?" "Thank you." "It's good Colombian. I suggest you take it black." The cup was chipped, clean. Pamela sat in the chair opposite him. "You must be after something. I can't for the life of me think what I could have that would be of any interest to a nice, strapping man like you. I like your shoes." "You were a technological lady?" "Yes. I had computer training in prison," she said without embarrassment. "I'm quite proficient. I'm writing a book about my life. It would be very nice if you were here about that. I did send it off, a first chapter, to All and Sundry, but I've heard not a squeak back." She lit a cigarette. "I'm not here about your book." "Pity. That was really why I let you in, but we all have these fantasies, don't we? You know, dreams of overnight success. A couple of small parts in The Avengers wasn't going to make me Hollywood star, but at the time I believed it might. I was in it with Honor Blackman, lovely-looking woman. She's kept her figure and her looks, but I suppose she never married a scumbag. That was my undoing." She got up to fetch an ashtray. "I met you with Victor Markham back in the 70s, De Jersey said. "Did you? He's been dead for years. Of course, after my problems, I lost touch with a lot of the old crowd. Do you play bridge?" "No." "You said something about lucrative was the word you used." "I'm running out of pleasantries, Mr. Simmons. I'm waiting with bated breath to hear why you've come to the fort. I may have a proposition for you." She laughed, a smoker's throaty laugh revealing coffee-stained teeth. "Well, talk, dear boy. You've come to the right person. I'm in need of anything that'll make me a bob or two." She looked at him with a sly smile. "Not legal, though, is it?" "No." "Anyone or anything who knew Victor Markham was bent..." She lit another cigarette as he sipped his coffee. "So why are you here, Philip Simmons?" "I need you to impersonate someone." "And what would it be worth to me?" "More than you would get from a publishing deal. I'll need you to stay in London. I have a place, it's not very comfortable, but it would only be for a short time." I think I'd rather like a gin. Can I offer you one?"
You're listening to In the Library on Audio Go.
Linda, let's talk a little bit now about your career, because it is the most extraordinary career. And on, of course, first reading, it just looks like everything you've touched has turned to success. Is that how it feels for you?
After Widows, which was my first success and, you know, the break of a lifetime, I think the way I work now has always spun off how I wrote my original script, because I'd never written for TV.
Quite.
Because invariably, when you're doing films or TV, there's always one of those little dodgy characters around the back of the set who says, "I can get you that sofa, 10 pence off." You know, I'll do that. They're all, I don't know where they come from, but they're always connected to a film set. And on one of the Minders I'd been acting in, there was this wonderful guy who sadly is no longer with us, but he was called Mickey Mahoney. Mickey Mahoney, I said, "Mickey, I want to try and write this script. would you know any sort of villains? Well, yeah, what do you want? I said, well, I want this and I want that. And as we got to know each other better and better and better, I actually said, do you know anyone that's ever killed somebody? And we were in the Thomas of Becket pub. And he said, well, you want somebody that done somebody in, is that right? So I said, yes. He said, hang on a second. Oi, you remember that pig farm when the bloke fed the bodies to the pigs? So I said, yes. Because I didn't. But, you know, I was on a roll.
Quite exactly.
I said, oh, yes. He said, well, it was Billy. Billy, come over here and meet Linda. And that started the most extraordinary journey for me, that I did make amazing forays into the criminal world and learnt very, very quickly, one, to keep my mouth shut, and two, keep my eyes and ears open.
But, Linda, you say keep your mouth shut, and yet, obviously, you're going to be writing about some of the stuff that they tell you. How do you manage to tread that fine line between keeping their confidence?
Okay.
So they tell you the information, them knowing that you are, once, especially after the first series is out, that you're going to be using some of that information and putting it on TV.
I have never mentioned who guided me through the waters before, now, ever. But now he's gone, I can actually say thank you to him aloud. But I never did. And so invariably, when I've ever disclosed something, like on a radio show, I've been very careful.
Yes.
They are very, very hidden in the script. So if somebody is a 25-year-old killer, I'll make him a lot older, describe him differently, distort it. The essence of who they were will come through to me. The police procedure. I learned very early on to go to the police. They were exactly as eager to make me get it right as were the people on the wrong side of the law.
Absolutely. So that was the start.
Yeah.
Widows.
And then there was a slump.
Then there were a whole lot of books. So you went from writing screenplays to writing...
Yeah. Only because I couldn't get a gig as a screenwriter, because everybody...
Even after the success of Widows, that surprises me enormously.
All they wanted was... I'd go in to the BBC and they go, we've got a great idea I want you to do. Four women in a bank, and they decide to rob it. I said, well, I did that with Widows. Oh, yes, well, you know, this is a bank there. Four prostitutes kill a guy and find the money in the... I said, I've done that. I've done it. And it was so frustrating. Yeah. And Pan Macmillan gave me the break to say, would you like to write a book?
They approached you?
Yep. And I jumped at it and said, yes, I would. So the legacy came out. I mean, I couldn't stop writing the legacy. They kept dying as another chapter went in. This book was so long. The poor editor, she had a nervous breakdown. I loved the writing of a novel to such an extent, because you're not bound in by all the constrictions of, oh, you can't have him going in a helicopter.
Exactly. Far too expensive to put on television.
Board? No. Get him back. So, you know, it's a wonderful freedom to write a novel.
And then Prime Suspect.
Yeah.
Tell us how that came about. I mean, extraordinary.
I owe Prime Suspect to a lady called Jenny Sheridan, because she was working at the BBC when I did a show called Civvies about paratroopers. And Jenny then went to work at Granada, and I was flat broke at this point. And she called me up and she said, oh, I'm now working commissioning at Granada. And she'd been my editor on Civvies. So over I go. And this time I thought, play it cool. Don't bring up anything. Let's hear what they want. So I actually said, what are you looking for? And she said, well, predominantly a police show, cop show. I said, oh, got one of those. Hadn't. So then she said, and we're really looking for one with a female leading role. I said, oh, that's what I've written. Female leading role. She said, oh, this is terrific. She said, we don't want it to be a uniform because, you know, we've got Juliet Bravo on and stuff. I said, no, plain clothes. She's plain clothes. She said, well, this is exactly what we want. What have you called it? Prime Suspect just popped out from nowhere. She said, well, that sounds terrific. Have you got anything down? I said, oh, yes, I've been working on this for quite a while. I ran home at such a pace and knocked out this treatment, Prime Suspect. Then was in a total state of panic.
How long did the treatment take? I mean, literally overnight or...
Oh, overnight. I got that out, you know, this homicide.
So you had the basic idea, the
just
the...
a female police officer, very high rank. That's all I put. Little kind of two paragraphs. Prime Suspect. Then I call the Metropolitan Police. And I said, I'm doing this show about a plainclothes police officer. Oh, yes, 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 yes. I said, I need a very high-ranking female police officer. Oh, we have many of those, many, yes. And I said, no, quite high rank. Yes. And I said, but plain clothes, murder, pause. Well, we have three in the London area. Three out of how many hundreds and hundreds of officers. So I said, would it be possible to meet one? And I met my Jane Tennyson. Her name was DCI Jackie Moulton. And whatever I had expected or thought I was going to write was blown out of the window when there was a ring on the doorbell. Hello, me duck. In came my prototype. And that lady reintroduced me to the police because they trusted her. I was in the forensic laboratories. I was in the pathology labs. I was forced to go and see an autopsy, which was pretty frightening. Mm. But that's how Prime Suspect came about.
And what drives you now? What drives Linda LaPlante?
I truthfully think that because in our world, you're only as good as your last book. You're only as successful as your last TV show. And because I am quite ambitious, I think I can go further. And I think that is what drives me. Mm. One step more, one step higher. I've just opened a film company, so all the money that I've stashed could go down the tubes because I'm taking such a risk. But I've never done a movie before. I've never...
By done, you mean write,
I've never written
produced...
a film and produced a film. That's my next goal. I never felt I was ready for one until now.
As a writer or as...
As a writer and as a producer. Because everything's a learning curve.
Mm, quite.
And I've had so much learning to do. To produce, to cast, is a tremendous amount of responsibility. And I'm somebody that says, oh, I want an Academy Award now. I want the Oscar. But you see, I believe everything is a possibility. What one doesn't and shouldn't ever do is write for the Oscar, write for the awards, write for the money. You write because you love it.
Linda LaPlante's love of writing is obviously still present. Her most recent novels, Blind Fury and Bloodline, have become international bestsellers, and Wrongful Death is due for release later this year. I'm Paul Blezard, and you can download titles by Linda LaPlante on Audiogo.
You've been listening to In the Library, a unique production for Audiogo.